Yeah, hi Brett. So thanks for joining us on our project here called Spotlight and Members. Yeah, thanks for coming.
Of course, yeah. It's really great to be here. I'm excited to do this.
Cool. Well, I think you're kind of one of these special people that has some really interesting things, but we're going to do this one where we're mostly talking about how you came to the Dharma, how you met Rinpoche, things like that. So let's start with that first question. How did you come to the Dharma?
Yeah. So I kind of fell into it. I grew up Catholic, and I mean, we lived a block away from the church, so we were an every Sunday church going family. When I went to college, I was, you know, just kind of that every college student kind of going away from home for the first time and not knowing who you are. I was always this jock, like into sports, and I get to college and now I'm not playing sports anymore. And so I was pretty depressed in a lot of ways, just not happy. And so I started searching. I studied philosophy in college and was still really fascinated by religion. And so one day I was actually at a bookstore and I just kind of randomly found my way to the Eastern religion section. Mm-hmm. And I picked up this random book. I was like, this looks interesting. It was Lama Surya Das, Awakening the Buddha Within. And I read that and I had no idea what it was saying, but for some reason it spoke to me. Like, mm-hmm. At the same time, I knew exactly what it was saying. And so that kind of led me towards Buddhism. That's how I found it. And that's what kind of led me on my path. After college, I decided to join the Peace Corps and I was really still interested in Buddhism. So I chose to go to Asia and I ended up going to Mongolia, Tibetan Buddhist country. So I lived in the middle of the Gobi Desert in a yurt, no running water. I did have electricity, but really intense lifestyle. And when I was going over there, I really wanted to, I was expecting that because it was a Buddhist country, everybody was going to be enlightened. So I would learn everything I needed to know over there. And then I got there and I found out that everybody was human. Just the same as, you know, Christians in America. Some are very devout. Some go to church a couple times a year. Same with Mongolians and their Buddhism. So that opportunity gave me a chance just to kind of get a little more into the culture of Buddhism. I didn't really know what Tibetan Buddhism was. I remember going to a monastery over there and there were, at the entrance, there were these giant like monsters, like standing on humans. I was like, this is Buddhism? What is this? But after that experience, I decided that Buddhism was really something I wanted to invest my time in. So I decided to go to Naropa to do their Master of Divinity program. And that's where my practice and study really started to deepen. At that point, I was really uncomfortable identifying as a Buddhist, but I had to do a month-long retreat, Adatu, and I did it up at SMC. And it was there that I actually took refuge vows because it really started to connect. So that was kind of my path to Buddhism. Mm-hmm.
Did you have much meditation instruction, meditation practice before you went to Naropa?
No, none at all. There was not much Buddhism in Iowa when I was starting to get into it. So I remember I'd buy like it was probably a tricycle or something and look at the back where they had all of the different sanghas listed. And I think there was like one listed in Iowa. And I went to it one time and like nobody was there. So mm-hmm. was just me kind of on my own reading. I remember the first time I ever meditated, I just looked up online how to meditate, and I found some directions that said, well, just close your eyes and look at the colors in your eyelids. And so I sat down and I closed my eyes and I looked at the colors, and about 5 seconds later, I got up and said, I need to send my email.
first stabs at it. Well, that's pretty interesting, because Datun is like a month-long meditation retreat with a lot of sitting practice, right? Like 8 or 10 hours a day or something.
So I guess before that, I was starting to meditate more. So when I was in Mongolia, I would try and meditate like an hour a day. I kind of have the personality when I get into something. Well, this was older, Brett. When I get into something, I like push myself really hard. So yeah, everybody else is doing like 5 minutes a day. Well, I'm going to do an hour a day. And that was beneficial in some sense. It was also, it made it so I only meditated like once a month for an hour, because it was painful. I was kind of moving in that direction, but it wasn't until I got to Naropa and really, I remember thinking when I got to Naropa, like, okay, I know pretty much everything there is to know about Buddhism. Started my first class and I was like, okay, I know nothing about Buddhism.
Were you studying Buddhist studies in Naropa then?
I did, yeah. So I did their Master of Divinity program. Mm-hmm. They kind of have two tracks that are a little different. And I did the focus of Indo-Tibetan Buddhism, which really meant that I just spent a month at Nitarta the first summer of my program.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So you're exposed a lot to those Nitartha teachings, because Naropa at that time was using the Nitartha teachings as part of their Indo-Buddhism studies, right?
Yes, definitely.
And that's pretty serious Buddhist studies, Nitartha material. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I was always really, I think probably the reason I was drawn to Tibetan Buddhism is because I'm a thinker. Like I like to study. I like to kind of really go for the really deep, hard, esoteric ideas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how did you come to Nalanda Bodhi and to Pongpa Rinpoche as a teacher?
Yeah, so that was really through Naropa, where I met Lama Tempa. Mm-hmm. I really connected with Lama Tempa there. He also scared me. I remember he was my meditation instructor there, and early on, I was starting to meditate a lot more, so I was feeling pretty good. And Lama Tempa, and sat down with him, and I said, hey, Lama Tempa, like, my meditation is going really well. Or he just stared at me, didn't say a word. And in my mind, I went to, wow, I don't know what I'm talking about, do I? I'm right for right now. So he knew how to teach me in a way that I didn't know I needed. Mm-hmm. So connecting with him. And then when I went to Naropa, I joined the military to become a military chaplain. And to become a chaplain, you have to be ordained. And so I was looking for a community. And because I didn't really know a whole lot about Buddhism at that point, I was like, all right, I'll just try this Nalanda Bodhi thing and see how it goes.
So in part because of Lama Tempa's connection to Nalanda Bodhi then, huh?
And then also just a bit of, being pushed in that direction.
Yeah. Well, I think we can be thankful for Lama Tempa. There's a lot of young Naropa students who have come to Nalanda Bodhi. Some have stayed, some have come and gone, but it's been a nice connection to have with Naropa that way through Lama Tempa. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what about Rinpoche? Were there weekend teachings that you went to with him while you were at Naropa, or when did you receive some teachings from him?
So actually the first summer I went to Nitartha, he actually wasn't there. He had something else going on, but he did like Zoom or it was probably Skype at the time, and gave a teaching there. So that was actually my first real experience with him. The next summer, I actually came back out to Seattle during Atarta to meet him, just to ask him to be my teacher, but also to talk about becoming ordained in LA so that I could become a chaplain. So those were my first few interactions with him.
Yeah, cool. So with all that time in terms of practice and study and meeting some good teachers and so on, so do you have kind of a favorite Dharma teaching or teachings? Because sometimes it's hard to say there's only one, but there's one or two probably that really are pretty meaningful for you, that really mean a lot in terms of your life and how you conduct yourself in the real, out in the world.
Yeah. Well, I think the teachings that really, that I connect with have definitely changed over time. Like I said before, I've as kind of a thinker, liking ideas, I was always drawn to the more esoteric teaching about Dzogchen and Mahamudra and Vajrayana, all that stuff, kind of looking for that answer to make everything better. But actually over the last year, the teaching, well, a couple of teachings I think have probably I've found become really important. And one is just the Bodhisattva path. In my Buddhist group in the military, we're actually, I'm working with them on 37 practices of a Bodhisattva. The other one is, I'm trying to think of this quote from Padmasambhava, something like your view should be as vast as the sky and your actions as fine as barley flour. I'm starting to recognize the importance of cause and effect. And so really focusing on my actions, on my thoughts, on especially, you know, right now with the election and just the politics of the time, you know, find myself when I'm reading a certain thing or watching a certain thing and seeing how that impacts my mind, which then impacts my, how I relate to the world in general. So I've really been working with that idea a lot lately and really trying to be as
so that sounds like it's applying a lot of mindfulness, you know, in terms of paying attention to your state of mind at times, you know, and then actually catching yourself perhaps before it turns into something more negative or something like that in some ways, huh?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's, you know, it's the first thing we learn.
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
Go back to it, not realizing the importance of it until...
Yeah, likewise. Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, well, that's really cool. Yeah, so... That sounds good. So being able to take that almost on a day-by-day basis and apply that kind of understanding, that kind of practice that comes from meditation practice. Yeah. Yeah. So we're not going to have time today to get much into, you know, how you became a chaplain or really what that means. And so I'd love to come back sometime and talk some more about that, because when you talk about like the 37 practices of a Bodhisattva, you know, it just astonishes me, you know, that you're sharing that teaching with people in the military and that you got people listening to that too, and maybe turning it into something heartfelt and meaningful for them too. So we'll have some more time to talk about that, I hope, at some point here pretty soon.
Sounds good.
Yeah. Yeah. So how are you coping with the pandemic? I mean, you kind of alluded to that too. And before we started, maybe you can tell that story too, that what you're doing right now, you're actually in quarantine.
So I'm doing all right. My wife has been working from home at the start of it. So we moved into a house about the day or two before the state shutdown started. So it's been kind of a wild time for us. I was I'm currently on active duty orders, and I was when this started. So we were sent home for about 2.5 months. And then I started back at the base after that. They let all of us chaplains come back to start taking care of people and checking in on people. There are a lot of restrictions on base as far as like how many people can be in a room and all that kind of stuff. But I'm actually quarantined for about a week because I did come into contact with somebody. I'm feeling fine.
Good. Hope that stays that way too. Yeah. So did you find in those early days of the pandemic that was there a need for your chaplaincy for, you know, to connect with people who were having some trouble?
Yeah, definitely.
Because I don't know. I mean, maybe the military has a different way of handling those things, or, you know, if you're in the military, you have a different way of being. But a lot of people really were needed some help in terms of talking to people. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, you know, people in the military are human, and they're dealing with this the same way all of us are dealing with it. Mm-hmm. You know, I found that people who were still working, because during everything, they sent non-essential people home. But the mission essential people had to be there the entire time to keep the base running and the mission that's going on out there. So for some of the people that were working, there were less people there. I'm specifically thinking of the security forces, the cops out on base. They were kind of loving it because there just weren't any people to cause them problems. Mm-hmm. And then there were others who were just struggling with being at home. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, people are struggling to figure out school with their kids. And but, you know, one thing I've really appreciated about the military is, and especially the base that I'm at, the commander that I have there is, he's been an amazing leader in all of this. You know, when talking about school, he said, I give everybody permission who has kids that have to stay home for school. You have permission to work from home. And if that means that we can't complete a specific mission, then that we just will go without that for the time being.
Wow.
So he's really taken the lead in terms of like caring for the people. And that's mm-hmm. been really interesting to see.
And making it work. Yeah, it's beneficial for everybody probably if, when you can do it that way. People having to worry a little bit less about how am I going to deal with this situation at home with kids and so on. Yeah, cool. Yeah. Well, that's cool. So maybe one last question. You kind of got to it to a certain extent, but I'd like to ask this. So what brings joy in your life, you know, maybe at times like this? Is there something special that goes on that kind of makes you happy or, you know, even though it can be a difficult time?
Yeah. My practice definitely brings me joy when I can be consistent with it. And my wife and I, we actually just had our 4-year anniversary last weekend. And so Every year we got married over Labor Day 4 years ago. And so every year we try and go on a 4-day camping trip. So we just got back from the mountains, and that brought a lot of joy. Doing our best to find some peace. My wife is a psychologist, so working extremely hard since all of this started. And you know, as a chaplain, we hold a lot of stuff for people. So when we can get an opportunity to get away and kind of let go of some of that, it's really good. So
yeah, it really makes a lot of sense to take care of yourself that way. And being out in the mountains is really a good way to do it. Yeah. Yep. Really cool. Well, thanks, Brett. That was great. I knew some of that story, but there were parts I didn't know about. So it was really nice to hear it. And, yeah, and I think we'd like to come back sometime soon and just talk some more too about how being a chaplain in the military works and and what you're doing there. Again, like, it's just amazing to me with, you know, taking that kind of teaching, like the 37 practices, and doing that. So we'll find time, and I hope you can, you're up for another round of conversation about that, about that part of your life.
Definitely. I think there's I think there's some stuff that I'm doing out there that people would be surprised by. I think it would be an interesting conversation.
Yeah. Cool. Okay. Well, thanks, Brett.
Thank you.